Deontology is not quite the same thing as moral absolutism, but for most purposes in a book about religion, there is no need to dwell on the distinction. Absolutists believe there are absolutes of right and wrong, imperatives whose rightness makes no reference to their consequences. Consequentialists more pragmatically hold that the morality of an action should be judged by its consequences. One version of consequentialism is utilitarianism, the philosophy associated with Bentham, his friend James Mill, 1773 to 1836, and Mill's son John Stuart Mill, 1806 to 73. Utilitarianism is often summed up in Bentham's unfortunately imprecise catchphrase, "The greatest happiness of the greatest number is the foundation of morals and legislation."
Not all absolutism is derived from religion. Nevertheless, it is pretty hard to defend absolutist morals on grounds other than religious ones. The only competitor I can think of is patriotism, especially in times of war. As the distinguished Spanish film director Luis Buñuel said,
"God and country are an unbeatable team. They break all records for oppression and bloodshed."
Recruiting officers rely heavily on their victims' sense of patriotic duty. In the First World War, women handed out white feathers to young men not in uniform.
"Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go, for your king and your country both need you so."
People despised conscientious objectors, even those of the enemy country, because patriotism was held to be an absolute virtue. It is hard to get much more absolute than the "my country, right or wrong" of the professional soldier, for the slogan commits you to kill whomever the politicians of some future date might choose to call enemies. Consequentialist reasoning may influence the political decision to go to war, but once war is declared, absolutist patriotism takes over with a force and a power not otherwise seen outside religion. A soldier who allows his own thoughts of consequentialist morality to persuade him not to go over the top would likely find himself court-martialed and even executed. The springboard for this discussion of moral philosophy was a hypothetical religious claim that, without a god, morals are relative and arbitrary. Kant and other sophisticated moral philosophers apart, and with due recognition given to patriotic fervour, the preferred source of absolute morality is usually a holy book of some kind, interpreted as having an authority far beyond its history's capacity to justify. Indeed, adherents of scriptural authority show distressingly little curiosity about the normally highly dubious historical origins of their holy books. The next chapter will demonstrate that in any case, people who claim to derive their morals from scripture do not really do so in practice. And a very good thing too, as they themselves, on reflection, should agree.
You've been listening to Richard Dawkins and Lala Ward reading from Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Professor Joan Roughgarden of Stanford University is considered one of the world's top evolutionary biologists. Her 2004 book, Evolution's Rainbow, Diversity, Gender, and Sexuality in Nature and People, called for the outright abandonment of Darwin's sexual selection theory and posited a new theory of social selection to take its place. Where Darwin saw competition as the essential reproductive strategy, Roughgarden saw cooperation as the key. The evidence is in nature and has been there all along, but it took someone like Roughgarden to be willing to look at it, minus the sexual prejudices of the mostly male scientific community. Roughgarden was in a position to command respect for her research as a result of her preeminent career. one which she was able to achieve in part because she herself was, until 1997, a man named John Roughgarden. At the age of 51, she decided to take a year's sabbatical to have the surgery that would make her a woman. Coming out as a transgendered person during a huge gay pride march in San Francisco in 1997 led her to take another look at how social preconceptions about gender influence science. She said, "I looked at this tumultuous, gargantuan group of people and said, 'There they are. There we are.' And then I said, 'But aren't we all impossible? Doesn't science, doesn't Darwin's theory of sexual selection tell us we shouldn't exist?' And then I said, 'Well, if science says so many people are wrong, maybe it's not the people that are wrong. It's the science that's wrong.' That's when I resolved to look into it." This talk was given at the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, in 2007.
Today's speaker is Dr. Joan Roughgarden. She received a Bachelor of Science in Biology and a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy from the University of Rochester in 1968, and she received a PhD in Theoretical Ecology from Harvard University in 1971, and is the author of 5 books and over 120 articles. Dr. Roughgarden is currently on the faculty at Stanford University. She has been there since 1972, where she founded and directed the Earth Systems Program. Joan has looked at Darwin's theory of sexual selection and found it to be problematic. Why is that so? Well, today we're going to hear about that from Joan herself.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you. And I would like to talk to you about the evolution of sex, gender, and sexuality. As we know, the topics involving sex, gender, and sexuality are in the news all the time because of political controversy about topics like gay marriage. They're also problematic in religious arenas where many denominations are discussing what's involved in the notion of inclusion and whether or not inclusion would be understood as extending to diverse expressions of gender and sexuality. And we might have hoped that if we took a scientific look at gender and sexuality, that we might find some clarity to settle these troubled times. But unfortunately, it will turn out that as scientists, we also are troubled by the extent to which diversity in gender and sexuality is being expressed among animals to an extent that we just had no idea and were unable to anticipate. And the repercussions of these findings extends all the way to foundational issues in evolutionary biology, and specifically to a topic in evolutionary biology called sexual selection theory, which is Darwin's theory of sex roles, which I'll get into in a minute. I need to be very clear up front that there is, I have no criticism whatsoever of the rest of Darwin, and there is only one particular topic, namely the topic of sexual selection, in which I feel he is mistaken. In the book Evolution's Rainbow that came out in 2004, I originally concluded that we needed to rethink gender and sexuality from the ground up, and we've now been engaged in doing that for the last 3 years in my laboratory. And then this other book that's come out recently over the summer, Evolution and Christian Faith, is an important, I believe an important effort on my part to tell the account of evolutionary biology in terms that are inherently friendly to a Christian tradition. So it's a book that does explain a lot of the principal metaphors in evolutionary biology in terms that are also found in the Bible. And so it's possible to avoid any inherent explanation or any explanation of evolutionary biology that sounds inherently hostile to people who have a Christian tradition. So let's get into this here. Darwin's theory of sex roles is, as I say, called his theory of sexual selection, and it was developed in 1871 and originally proposed about a fairly specific issue, namely the traits like the tails on peacocks, called Ornaments. And he wrote, motivated really by this phenomenon, he enunciated some empirical claims as well as an explanation for them. He says here that males of almost all animals have stronger passions than females, and so we get the notion of the passionate male. And the female, with the rarest of exceptions, is less eager than the male. She is coy. We get the coy female. Now notice here the phrase, almost all, and with rarest of exceptions. So these are being claimed as empirical universals, so that the exceptions are pretty rare. And this third point is his explanation for why these universals occur. It's because females choose mates who are more attractive, vigorous, and well-armed, just as man can give beauty to his male poultry. And the reference here is to the activity of breeders in breeding fighting cocks for a cockpit. And as you know, you could breed roosters so that they were good fighters. The idea here is that females choose as their mates males who are well-armed or attractive, and or attractive. The armaments themselves might be considered attractive. And that in doing so, females in effect breed males to have the traits that males exhibit. And in particular, for something like the peacock's tail, Darwin refers to the peahen as having an aesthetic that leads them to prefer to mate with males with good tails. And so it's the female's aesthetic that is being expressed here in the male's body. This is the theory of sexual selection. And it continues today. Here's a quotation from Jerry Coyne, a geneticist at the University of Chicago, and he now asserts that we understand males who can produce many offspring with only minimal investment spread their genes most effectively by mating promiscuously. So instead of the passionate male, we now have the promiscuous male. And female reproductive output is far more constrained by metabolic costs of producing eggs or offspring, and thus the female's interests are served more by mate quality than by mate quantity. By quality, he means genetic quality. The idea here, then, is that males, because of making sperm, and sperm being very cheap, males are supposed to be passionate and promiscuous and to simply fertilize any female they can find. On the other hand, females are coy because they're supposed to make these very expensive eggs and they're supposed to not want, so to speak, to have those investments, the genetic significance of those investments diluted by mating with genetically inferior males. So instead of the passionate male, we have the promiscuous male. Now, the problem is that, as you can see, this narrative is basically a restatement of Darwin's narrative right here about mate choice. And these narratives are intended to explain these generalizations, that most males are supposed to be passionate and most females coy. But the problem is that, as you might imagine, as you start taking more and more data on lots of species, these generalizations emerge as no longer true, because there are lots of species in which the males aren't passionate and the females aren't coy, and vice versa. You know, the males may be coy and the females passionate. Nonetheless, this narrative continues to have a status of its own. There's something inherently appealing about this narrative of the passionate male and the coy female, the cheap sperm and the expensive egg, which means that it continues to have a life of its own in spite of the need to revise the empirical claims that it was supposed to explain in the first place. And this is the problematic aspect of sexual selection theory, is that there's a truth status actually to the narrative independent of the facts. So what began as a fairly special theory, which I call here the central narrative of male-female social dynamics, one of mate choice, has now extended both up and down to become, in effect, a system, an evolutionary system of sex, gender, and sexuality. From the central narrative, there are further propositions about how the theory, the mathematical theory of social behavior should be developed, and correlative accounts about the origin of sexual reproduction itself and the origin of the male-female binary. And then moving ahead, there are derivatives of this sexual selection theory that pertain to the style and characteristics of sexual reproduction. And then what's particularly important right here is that, as you'll see in the next few slides, there are a lot of species which are just flat-out contradictions to sexual selection theory. And so when you find a contradiction, then you have to then gin up some workaround for it. And so there are a whole slew of workarounds for deviations, if you will, from sexual selection. And I call these peripheral narratives for sex gender diversity. And finally, of course, there's the application to humans, and you've probably heard this basically being taken up in pop psychology all the time. So we're now looking at a large body of propositions that are all logically interconnected to one another and make it very difficult to test. Because if you test any little piece, then there's another sort of special argument that's accreted to the sexual selection system. And so it puts us in the position of having to take a relatively radical stance if you think that some of this is wrong, in saying that the whole system has to be rethought from top to bottom. And that's the circumstance that I currently think we're in, is needing to actually revisit the entire conceptual structure for sex, gender, and sexuality. So what I'd like to do then is to show you four slides of particularly problematic species for the sexual selection narrative, and then go into some further data about inconsistencies with the sexual selection work. Research, and then go into some of the ideas from my lab as to how to replace sexual selection theory with something else. Now, here are four slides of particularly problematic species. The male and female in biology are defined in terms of gamete size, and so a male, by definition, is a maker of small gametes, and a female, a maker of large gametes. And the sexual selection narrative assumes that there's a gender binary. It doesn't, a sex binary. It doesn't analyze whether or not there should be a sex binary. The problem is that the most common body plan is for organisms to be both male and female simultaneously. If you look at all the plants, for example, they have both, they produce pollen and they produce ovules, and they have a stigma. And for those of you who work on marine invertebrates, for example, they're very commonly hermaphroditic as well. And even if you look at fish, if you go snorkeling on a coral reef, about 30% of the species you see there are members of species in which individuals are both male and female. So if they're male and female at different times, then they are said to be sequentially hermaphroditic. If they're male and female at the same time, they're simultaneously hermaphroditic. So this is a case of a species that in which the individuals go from female to male. Here they go from male to female, and here they're male and female simultaneously. So we don't really have a theory for the specialization of sexual reproduction into or the derivation, if you will, of sexual reproduction into specialized morphs in which an individual is only male all of its life and another individual is only female all of its life. And this is then a prerequisite for sexual selection theory. But the sex binary itself as a body plan is problematic. Now, another major issue are the species that exhibit so-called sex role reversal, in which it's the male who's coy and the female who's passionate, the flip of the peacock situation. And here you have seahorses, for example, which are derived from pipefish. In fish, it happens that that when there's parental care by adults, it's usually the male. Now, in most fish, the eggs are just released and are not cared for. But if they do care for them, which is about 10% of the species, it's usually the males that are providing the parental care. And on pipefish, the males glue the eggs to their tummy, and they swim around with the males in their tummy. In seahorses, there's a skin flap elaborated on the tummy, which forms a pouch, and so the eggs are deposited into the pouch. And so here's a female depositing eggs into the male's pouch right here, so that the male, in effect, becomes pregnant. And when this situation happens, the male can take longer to, quote, graduate the eggs than it takes for a female to produce them, so that the males who are ready to receive eggs are in short supply relative to females who are ready to deposit them, which then leads potentially to conflict among females for access to available males. Now, this is called sex role reversal. And we have no theory whatsoever for when it takes place. But it's a contradiction to sexual selection theory on its face. Now, it's also very important theoretically because it shows there's no necessary connection between gamete size and sex roles, because male seahorses make tiny sperm, just like males in general do. Nonetheless, they're providing most of the parental investment. So you can't deduce the properties of male behavior from gamete size. The mere fact that they make sperm is not sufficient. It might be relevant. Now, another major issue involves the number of templates per sex. According to the Darwinian account, there is one template per sex, namely the passionate male and the coy female. And so in principle, you could fix up the Darwinian templates by doing a lot of field work and finding out what males really were like and what females really were like, and thereby have a more elaborate account of the template. But the problem is that in a lot of species, there are multiple templates per male and multiple templates per female. And this is a case of a seabird that's on mudflats here in Europe, called the ruff, named for the collar. Some of the males have black collars, some of the males have white collars, and some of the males have no collars. And this is obviously a genetic trait. And this is a female right here. And what happens with these in this species is that the males at the time of the black colored males at the time of mating go to areas where they set up little courts adjacent to one another, almost in a hexagonal array, if you will. And they set up these territories there. And meanwhile, the white colored males flock with the females. But before the females come to the arena where the black males have gotten their courts, before the females leave, the white-collared males leave first. And they come to the courts where the arena where the black-collared males exist is called a lek, L-E-K. So the white-collared males come to the lek where they're solicited by the black-collared males to join them. And so when the females arrive, they can see certain courts that have a pair of males in them. And then it's been shown that the females preferentially then lay eggs in courts with pairs of males. Meanwhile, this male over here, without a ruff or a collar, has just been recently discovered, and its social role isn't clear. But I show it right here because this is an instance of a same-sex mating right here, or same-sex mounting, between a black-colored male and this male right here. And of course, it can go the other way as well. This male could mount that one. And this sets up the issue of homosexual mountings. Now, I've used the phrase gender to refer to each of these templates right here. So I'll use terminology like three genders of males when discussing a species like this. So this would be a species in which there are two sexes, but there are three genders of males, and so far at least only one gender of female. But for lots of lizards and fish and so forth, there are also multiple genders of females. So this would be a homosexual and heterogenderal mating right here. And then this refers to a homosexual mating that is also homogenderal. So it's now clear that there are over 300 species of vertebrates in which homosexual homogenderal mating is known in the primary literature, primary peer-reviewed literature. These happen to be just slides from primates here. But these are gorilla, male-male gorillas, and these are female-female bonobos, and bonobos are, as you know, our closest relative. And bonobos are very humanoid. They're often bipedal. This is a female bonobo here. And when female bonobos mate, they face each other and rub their vulvas together and have an orgasm. And so there's a lot of, if you will, reciprocal pleasure being exchanged by these contacts. And this is a very clear phenomenon. And of the 300 species, there are over 300 species that are now known, and I want to cite Bruce Badgemiel's book, Biological Exuberance, for reviewing a lot of this literature initially. Of these, there are very few generalizations you can make. In some species, it's only the males. In other species, it's only the females. In some species, it's both males and females. And also, sometimes it's only 10%. Sometimes it's, as in the case of bonobos, all of the females participate in same-sex mating as well as between-sex mating. And so it points to a social role for homosexuality that depends on the social circumstance within the species. And probably its greatest significance is that it points to the existence of friendship in animal societies, because what's going on here is kind of a tactile communication of reciprocal pleasure. And so these two animals right here are obviously in close touch with one another, and they can tell a great deal about each other's physical and, if you will, emotional state because of this. So there's this whole panoply, therefore, of phenomenology that lies outside either prior to or subsequent to the Darwinian narrative. And so this, to me, was a tip-off that there was a big problem. Now, on the other hand, people active in sexual selection theory have felt that this was giving undue, that my critique of sexual selection was giving undue emphasis to so-called exceptions. So these would be viewed as exceptions to the norm that sexual selection templates are supposed to represent. But it's becoming increasingly clear that the sexual selection account doesn't even apply to the poster species, if you will, to which it's directed. Here is, so these studies are just coming out now, and I'd like to cite two of them for you. Here's a study of the collared flycatcher from Europe. And this was studied for 24 years on an island off of Sweden with over 8,500, you know, marked birds. This is heavy-duty field work here. And here are the two birds, and the males have a little white spot called the badge, and these are the females. According to the party line on a species like this, females are supposed to choose males with a large spot. They're supposed to prefer males with a large spot. And in doing so, they're supposed to provide their young with a large spot, which will similarly be attractive in the next generation. That's called the sexy son hypothesis. An alternative interpretation is that this is an indicator of the genetic quality of the male and of his ability to be fit. And so this is supposed to underlie female choice. Now, what do you actually find? First of all, you do find that the badge size is slightly heritable at 0.38 here. Now, here's the really key thing. The heritability of male fitness, however, is zero. So that means to say that if you're a female collared flycatcher, looking at all these males out here, some of them will sire a lot. There'll be a lot of variation in fitness among the males, but it's not genetic. And so if you're choosing a male for his genes, it's a waste of time. And so what we actually find here is that the heritability of female choice for bad size is also zero. That means if you as a female happen to like large bad sizes, your daughters don't. There's no heritability to the preference. And therefore, it winds up being that the genetic correlation between female choice of big badge size and male badge size is zero. It's a very interesting study right here, because they're willing to say in the abstract and up front that this refutes the sexual selection story for mate choice of badge size in this species. And this is 2006, same year, again 2006, we have something called the blue tit in England. Now, males and female blue tits look identical, basically, from under regular light, visible light. And in 98 and 99, about 10 years ago, became clear that that under ultraviolet light, the males had a brighter top up here, and this cap, so-called cap color, so that there actually was some sexual dimorphism between these two sexes, but you had to look for it under ultraviolet light. So this looked like a great thing for the sexual selection narrative, that after all, the males really were different. And then that was followed by studies saying that females preferred males with a big, with a bright cap right here. But now it's become clear that cap color is not heritable. So here's the heritability of the cap color, and it's 0.1 plus or minus 0.1. So this is not significant, and here's the scatter diagram of parent offspring cap colors right here. Similarly, the genetic correlation between cap color and fledgling return to breed, which is a measure of survivorship, whether the birds that are fledged come back to breed, this is also zero. See, 0.4 plus or minus 0.4. Then the genetic correlation between cap color and body size of the offspring. So the idea is that if a female mates with a male with a large cap right here, do they wind up producing bigger offspring? The answer is no, that there's no correlation to head length, and no correlation to tarsus length. So again, you know, it's not there. And what's interesting about it is that the studies say so up front. When I was reviewing for Evolution's Rainbow and going through studies like this, over and over again I'd find that there'd be a critical flaw in the work, but it would be suppressed into sort of a small little paragraph in the discussion. It's finally becoming possible to say up front in the open literature that the sexual selection narrative isn't working, even for the species that it looks like it's designed for. Now, why is this? Why is sexual selection falling apart? I think it's actually pretty obvious why. Because there's an internal contradiction to sexual selection theory, which even is dignified by a name in the literature called the paradox of the Lek. And here's what it is. The paradox of the Lek is that if females are supposed to be selecting males for their genes, then after 20 generations of this, there should be no bad genes left, and any remaining variation in the males should simply be environmental. That's, in fact, what's being observed. But I'll come to that in a second. But this paradox of the Lek, called the Lek paradox here, has then led to a whole literature which is intended to resolve the Lek paradox in some way. Basically, you have to concoct a scheme to regenerate bad genes in the males so that the females have some reason to keep selecting males on the basis of their genes. And these are very ingenious. So there's now a whole slew of these. And most recently, in 2006, there's another one that came out right here. The reason I cite this table is that it's a nice review of all of these papers that have gone on here. Now, the real point is that if there is, in fact, a literature intended to resolve the paradox of the Lek, it hasn't been resolved. And so it looks pretty obvious to me that it's not going to be resolved, that it's actually a fundamental logical flaw, that you need to have some external generator of bad variation in order to sustain the continued existence of female choice for males on the basis of their genes. And this is work from Errol Ace in my lab. We've done a survey of extra pair paternity in birds and of all the papers that are published about this. And extra pair paternity refers to nests in which some of the eggs are either fathered or mothered by birds in an adjacent nest. Now, the existing theories about this all refer to cheating and so forth, that the males try to steal copulations from adjacent nests, and the male at a nest in which that happens is said to be cuckolded. This whole literature is filled with this language. But the whole rationale, according to sexual selection theory, for why females should welcome or solicit extra pair copulations is supposed to be that they get a genetic upgrade through this, that by mating with a male in an adjacent nest, they're able to get good genes that they can't get from the male in their own nest. Now, is it true? Well, if you look at the studies, when we went through all the literature on this, 106 studies that actually make conclusions, that come to conclusions about the good gene hypothesis. Of those, 61 actually assert that it isn't true. 45 claim that it is true. And this is of the species, so some of these studies are of the same species. Again, we get 29 saying that it's rejected and 22 saying it's supported. But it can't be very true. And furthermore, we've been doing a meta-analysis on this, and there's a tendency to over-report the cases where it's supported. So this is even an overestimate here. And similarly, there's also a corollary hypothesis called the compatible genes hypothesis, in which females are supposed to be looking for males in an adjacent nest who have genes compatible to theirs, rather than necessarily better genes, but just better for her. And even those show a majority of cases rejecting it. So at the very least, other hypotheses are needed. So as you can see right here, we're left with a situation for sexual selection theory in which, A, there's zillions of exceptions, thousands and thousands of species don't mesh up with the sexual selection templates or explanation. The actual studies of the species that are supposed to which sexual selection is supposed to apply, that are designed almost, as it were, for sexual selection theory, the data on those shows that it doesn't work. And then finally, it has internal contradictions to it, namely the paradox of the Lek. So for these reasons, I invite you to consider the possibility that the whole sexual selection theory should be junked, lock, stock, and barrel, and we should rethink sex, gender, and sexuality from the ground up. Now, your reaction to that might be one of great dismay, oh my gosh. On the other hand, let's think positively about it. It means that we are in a time when we can do some research which pertains to the foundational structure of evolutionary biology. This is really a fabulous opportunity. And I know my grad students are excited about this, and so am I. I mean, this is not something to be alarmed about. This is a fabulous opportunity. And we've been working on a replacement for sexual selection theory that covers this whole suite of issues, from the origin of the male-female binary on through to the formation of secondary sexual characters. The basic distinction is this, that in sexual selection, behavior is understood to be a mating system, and that goes back to Darwin's original narrative that that interprets the behavior in terms of mating success, and therefore natural selection arises from differences in mating success. And in this narrative, females are a limiting resource for males. Males compete for mating opportunities, and females choose males for genes. Now, our alternative that we've termed social selection envisions that social behavior is actually an offspring rearing system. It's not all about getting mates. It's about producing young. And therefore, natural selection arises from differences in success at rearing young. And this obviously has to be true in some sense, because natural selection depends on the number of offspring that are placed into the next generation. That's what evolutionary success is about. The problem with sexual selection is, in focusing on mating, is that it's elevated one component of fitness into a goal of its own. And therefore, in our account right here, what's going on when you have courtship and all the sort of stuff between males and females is that males and females are negotiating bargains and side payments with one another to maximize offspring production. The as distinct from offspring genetic quality. So basically, female choice, for example, of males is about how to raise the largest number of young, not how to shove certain genes into those young, which is what the sexual selection narrative would do. And females are negotiating bargains and side payments in part to control the offspring-rearing social infrastructure. This is really important because young are not just raised, or not just sort of left to fend on their own. Typically, offspring grow and mature and survive in the context of a social infrastructure. And so a lot of the behavior, according to us, according to our hypothesis, concerns the maintenance and control of the social infrastructure. Now, I'd like to show you a few slides from current research in my lab that highlights the work that people in my lab presently are doing. So this is work from Priya Iyer concerning the origin of the male-female binary, which in evolutionary biology goes under the name of the origin of anisogamy. Now, isogamy means the gametes have the same size, isogamy. Anisogamy means they have different sizes. So the primitive condition is taken to be a case where the two gametes are the same size, and the question then is what is the evolutionary force that would lead to the gametes developing different sizes? If you can explain that, then you've explained the origin of the male-female binary. The party line for the origin of the male-female binary involves gametic conflict. The idea is that you start out with two types of gametes that are the same size, and one of them cheats a little bit. The protosperm cheats to become more numerous, and the proto-egg then responds by becoming larger, under the supposition that if it got smaller too, then the zygote would actually suffer. So this gametic conflict theory, which traces to Parker in the 70s, argues that conflict is at the origin of the male-female distinction, that males and females, the sex binary is born of conflict. And it locates, therefore, conflict at the most elemental level of the male-female relationship. Now, we've pointed out something which actually draws on some insights from the 1930s, which is simply that the gametic contact rate is increased when the gametes have different sizes. So just ask yourself, if you had two clouds of gametes, imagine two clouds of gametes were coming together, what do you do to get the largest number of collisions, the contacts, which would be the largest number of fertilizations? Well, if they're both the same size, like this cloud here and this cloud here, as they come together, you'll only get a few contacts. But imagine that that if you take the one gamete type and make them as big as the zygote itself, make the other gamete type as minuscule as possible, so that you have a cloud of little specks right here. If these two clouds collide, then all of these eggs wind up getting fertilized, which is what the green dots are supposed to indicate. So therefore, you can develop a one locus, two allele model in which there's basically directional selection in favor of size dimorphism in the two gametes simply to maximize contact rate. And so it becomes advantageous simply to have two sizes of gametes, just in order to increase fertilization frequency. And this gives rise to a fitness diagram right here, in which you do get a U-shaped distribution. So this is sperm size versus egg size. So you get a big egg and a tiny sperm. And here you have a big egg and a tiny sperm. And the only reason it's U-shaped has to do with which one started out being big. So in other words, it's equivalent if you had type A being tiny and type B being big, or type A being big and type B being tiny. It's a so-called priority effect. It has nothing to do with conflict. It simply has to do with which one started out that way. So this provides an entirely alternative narrative to the origin of the male-female binary that doesn't rest on conflict. Now, another thing that we've worked on concerns the introduction of cooperative game theory into animal behavior. Now, the way we've been viewing the way animal behavior should be modeled is as a two-tier process. Now, the background to this is that John Maynard Smith introduced game theory to evolutionary biology a while ago, and in his approach, the behaviors themselves were viewed as evolutionary strategies, so that you would have, for example, a gene for aggressiveness and a gene for passiveness, or a gene for being a hawk, or a gene for being a dove. And then from an assignment of a genotype to each behavioral strategy, you then work out what a so-called evolutionary stable strategy is, which would be an array of behaviors which would be evolutionarily stable, assuming the behaviors themselves were genetic. Now, that's a real problem, of course, because behaviors are not generally that genetic. And behavior, social behavior, actually develops through interaction of the parties with one another. So we've decided to introduce a two-tier or two-level approach in which the behavior unfolds on a within-generation developmental time frame, and the rules of the game evolve on a between-generation time frame. So we have a behavioral tier, which is like a developmental tier, and an evolutionary tier. And the way you can think of it is like this. I live in San Francisco, some of you may know. And one of the things that happens there in the Civic Center area is you can go and see all these men playing chess. Have you ever seen that, where there's like a public square where everybody's playing chess? So this, the game theory stuff, applies to each pair of people playing a game. But the population is the whole plaza of game players. And so we have to have a separate model for how a pair of players plays, and then embed that within a genetic model for how the game itself evolves. And so on our account, what's genetic are the rules of the game, not the minute-by-minute strategies. Now, that's really nice, because if you do at the evolutionary tier, the theorizing has to be in terms of a non-competitive game. But at the behavioral tier, you could have a cooperative game as well as a competitive game. And the difference is like the difference between playing chess and playing Monopoly. In playing chess, the two players can't talk to each other. But if you're playing Monopoly, you can talk to each other, you can make side payments, deals, all this sort of thing. And so you have scope then for introducing cooperative behavior into the behavioral tier. So the way it would work would be something like this, where if you have player one and player two, and these are the payoffs that accrue to each player. If player one is doing behavior A and player two is doing its behavior A, so this would represent a payoff of 2 to player one and a payoff of 6 to player two. And these are all the other possibilities right here. If this is the way the game is set up, then if they're playing competitively, that is, they're not allowed to talk to each other, then what happens is that the two players will move over here and wind up down here. This is because player two will always play A, since 6 is greater than 5 and 8 is greater than 0. And once they're over on this column, then player one will always play B, because 4 is greater than 2. So if they're playing competitively, they wind up down here. But if they can talk to one another, and by golly, animals can, then whole other vistas open up. Because player one over here could say, well, now this is really what I'd like, because I get a 10 over here. And player two can say, tough. But player one could threaten. And if player one establishes a credible threat, say by being willing to do this, player one can force player two into a negotiation in which player two will agree to play this some of the time in return for cessation of the threat. And it's analogous, really, to a labor management negotiation. Now, John Nash, in the 1950s, developed a theory for how such a negotiation would work out, which is called the Nash bargaining solution right here, which is this yellow-green dot. So this point up here represents what player two would like. This point over here represents what player one would like. And you find the best compromise in here by a formula that Nash introduced, which is very convenient. It's the product of the two fitnesses. And so this maximizes the product, which I term the team production function, or the team fitness function, with the working as a team. Now, what Nash didn't talk about is how you get to the optimal bargain. And traditionally in game theory, what's been done is to envision that the two players play non-cooperatively and nonetheless wind up at a cooperative outcome. The way this works is if they play with each other through a war of attrition. So imagine, for example, that two... I work on lizards. Imagine two lizards, for example, that are squaring off against each other, going back and forth and fighting, and finally they both collapse in exhaustion, and the boundary between them winds up being the way in which they split space. If they both play to exhaustion, the point at which the standoff occurs represents a cooperative division of the resource, in this case space. But they don't have to fight their way to a cooperative outcome. They could actually cooperate on their way to cooperative outcome. And so this is where we've used the notion of friendship that is exhibited in physically intimate traits, like the homosexuality, but also in all other kinds of physical intimacies, where birds will preen each other, mammals will groom each other, and so on. So that if animals are actually working together and climbing the team fitness function, they converge directly on the Nash bargaining solution without having to fight their way there. And that's a far more efficient mechanism for attaining a cooperative solution than through fighting it out. So we've introduced, therefore, cooperative game theory along with cooperation as the actual mechanism by which the cooperative outcome is attained. And a case, for example, this is work from Errol Ace that we're applying it to is extra pair paternity, viewed as a side payment right here. And this is the last slide I have. The phenomenon, as I mentioned earlier, of extra pair paternity is where some of the eggs in a nest are parented by the adults of adjacent nests. And this is normally interpreted as cheating or as parasitism of some sort. Now, we've taken an approach that draws on the theory of marriage, the economic theory of marriage, in this way. This is a so-called a pairing matrix or marriage matrix. And I've shown right here birds, where the size indicates how experienced the bird is. So this is a very experienced bird, and it's male, and this is an inexperienced bird. And if it's true that the two experienced birds can both produce or can produce seven eggs, then the payment, the fitness that both get from pairing with one another is seven and seven. And on the other hand, if the inexperienced birds can only raise three eggs apiece, then this is what they have. Now, if this is the pairing matrix, then obviously the two experienced birds should pair up with one another, because that's what's best for them. And then the two inexperienced birds are stuck. They just have to pair with one another, and they're going to get three eggs apiece. Now, if side payments are allowed, we get a different possibility. For example, the inexperienced bird right here could offer the experienced bird two of its eggs. You could come and parent two of the eggs. So that now, if in return for letting the inexperienced bird pair with the experienced female, in that case, then, the experienced male would wind up producing six plus two young, namely the six that it gets from being with this female, plus the two that it gets from the extra pair mating, giving it eight altogether, which is greater than seven. And a similar argument goes for the female, where the females could agree as well to dump eggs or put eggs in one another's nest. And with a scheme like this, it changes the optimal pairing. The optimal pairing would then be with a experienced bird and an inexperienced bird. And what's interesting is that the sum of the eggs produced by this pairing arrangement with these side payments is greater than the sum here, so that the, so to speak, the total welfare increased as a result of this. Now, meanwhile, so this produces a prediction of when extra pair paternity could occur, and not viewed as a matter of deceit whatsoever. But conversely, you could also make up matrices right here in which side payments would not be favored. And so you could therefore develop an ecological theory of when side payments occur and when they don't occur, and hope to predict in that way the distribution of extra pair paternity in nature, which is an entirely new theory. And desperately needed, because as I showed you from the previous data, the studies already are showing that the genetic theory, that is females choosing males to get a genetic upgrade, that already isn't working. So we need something new. So this will give you an idea that once you break out of or allow yourself to break out of the sexual selection universe, it opens up all sorts of imaginative possibilities. It just lets you think in new directions. And I have no idea if this hypothesis will actually bear out when we get around to checking it and so on. But the sexual selection theory at the moment is acting as a mental straitjacket on us. The modeling that we're starting or planning to do with Priya is about the evolution of complementarity. So considered as an economic arrangement, considering the pair bond as an economic arrangement, the question then is, under what conditions does it pay for the male and the female to be complementary as opposed to substitutable in an economic sense? And so we would be looking at the conditions for the evolution of complementarity versus substitutability, and there would clearly be advantages to both under some circumstances, and so that's what we need to look into. I mean, the question is, what matters genetically? On our two-tier account, what matters genetically are the rules of the game, and what doesn't matter genetically are the genetic properties of the male from a female's point of view. And that's because the males are basically equivalent genetically. In other words, if I were a female going into a singles bar and I saw all these guys standing there, and if I even knew their genotypes, it wouldn't matter, because I'd be picking them on the basis of which one would lead to the largest number of young that I could successfully rear. Whereas the difference in terms of whether or not they vacate the nest, whether they protect the nest, what do they actually do, that difference is huge compared to the strength of selection that might possibly underlie genetic differences. Darwin is very clear that it's the males that are doing certain things, the females that are doing certain things. If you find that the sexes reverse, that's called sex role reversal, which is a contradiction on its face. If you just look at the English language, you know, and you just parse a sentence, and if the sentence says that the males are more passionate and the females coy, and then you find a species where the females are passionate and the males are coy, from the standpoint of the English language, one contradicts the other. That's the sense in which sex role reversal is a contradiction of the Darwinian narrative. Now, the attempt is, we have to be honest about what we're not explaining and not kid ourselves into thinking that it's still okay just because we've done some verbal footwork on this. And this is the problem I'm having with the sexual selectionists, is that they're mistaking the footwork for, they're evading the reality of a contradiction that they're stuck with because they take refuge in the footwork. Now that's where I can leave it with you, and there we are.
Dr. Joan Roughgarden, speaking in 2007 at the NIH Lecture Series on Evolution and Medicine. Thanks for listening.